this was also when I was starting to come out as trans, and like I vividly remember performing on stage with her at a United Auto Workers Hall outside Detroit, and like I put on a mini skirt to like go get on the stage, and she kind of like gave me a look and was like, are you sure you want to do that? And I was like, yeah, I'm gonna do it. And she was like, all right, let's fucking do it. And like we got up there and like launched into Solidarity Forever, and you know, within 10 minutes, like all the auto workers were like, fuck yeah, like whatever, you know?
You're listening to The Rhythm of Rebellion with Taina Asili. Welcome to another episode of The Rhythm of Rebellion. I'm your host, Taina Asili, and today I am thrilled to speak with Evan Greer, a powerhouse trans and queer activist, writer, and musician based in Boston. Evan's journey is a dynamic interplay of musical wit, grassroots activism, and a fervent dedication to justice. She has gracefully evolved her sound from riot folk roots to a more layered indie pop aesthetic with an anarcho-punk soul. Her recent album, Spotify is Surveillance, has garnered praise from NPR, Rolling Stone, and Pitchfork. As a touring musician and speaker, Evan has shared stages with a diverse array of artists, including Pete Seeger, Eve Six, and Tom Morello of Rage Against the Machine, who has dubbed her as a heck of a guitar player. Beyond her musical endeavors, Evan serves as the director for Fight for the Future, a digital rights nonprofit. An eloquent commentator on TV and radio, Evan passionately advocates for issues related to free speech, technology, and human rights. On a personal note, Evan is my musical co-conspirator sister and one of my dearest friends. We have spent many years making music and mischief together, from the nationwide Rock Against the TPP tour to our Break the Chains tour across Europe, and so much more. Join me as we explore Evan's unique sonic landscape, delving into her collaborations, influences, and the power of music to spark rebellion. Hey, Evan, thank you so much for joining me. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
I am doing well, and I have been wanting to get you on this show for a while. We actually did, back at season one, we did an episode live in person together. That never aired. So this is sort of a redo. And it's, you know, it's different, right? Because we know each other very, very well. So for me, this interview is about sharing what I love about you with the world.
Aww.
But also, you know, I know that there are pieces of your story that I don't know a lot about. And I think the piece that I was really thinking about, like, do I actually know how Riot Folk came about and some of these early years of your music life? So I thought we could start there.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, for me, music and politics have always been pretty inextricably linked. The very first song I ever wrote was a few days after 9/11. I was a high school student and could pretty quickly see that the reaction of our government was going to be a push toward war and violence, to meet violence. So yeah, I was kind of starting to get wrapped up in the growing anti-war movement at that time. But it was also when I picked up an acoustic guitar. I was like learning, you know, how to play like silly covers like Sweet Home Alabama or something embarrassing now. I remember like playing that song at my like high school assembly or something like that. Hmm. And like having a few teachers come up to me and being like, you know, I've been wanting to say something, but like, I was a little afraid to like speak up because like this just happened. And that was sort of just like a window into like, oh, like songs can be powerful and can be, you know, not just like moving, but like utilitarian. Like you can use a song to do something. And yeah, I mean, one of the first times I ever performed in front of people was at a big anti-war protest that I helped organize on Boston Common. And that was it for me. Like I was totally all in on both music and activism. And so when I finally went off to college, you know, I was increasingly starting to be in touch with other musicians that shared those sort of like early left anarchist values that were, you know, very active in movements against US imperialism, that were very active in the movement around global justice, following the big protests that helped shut down the WTO in Seattle. So that was kind of like the world, the activist world that I was like percolating up in. And yeah, I just started to meet folks like Ryan Harvey from Baltimore and Adam Roland, who we met up with in St. Louis at an early protest that I remember. And like, we were all sort of solo musicians who were, you know, kind of like bringing forward this like new generation of like protest folk music. But that was like pretty distinct from the folk music that like we kind of grew up on. And that was much less like kind of like, oh, let's all get along, peace, kumbaya, and was more like, we're going to fucking riot and tear this system to the ground. Can I say fuck on your podcast? Is that a thing?
Yes, you can. You can say
okay,
fuck.
Good. We started calling ourselves riot folk as like a genre almost. And, you know, obviously it was an allusion to Riot Girl, you know, the feminist punk movement that a lot of us were really inspired by. And, you know, our music definitely was like punk adjacent. I actually didn't really get into punk until like much later. I very much was rooted in like folk music and like kind of like 60s, like rock and roll. You know, I just like stole all my dad's records basically. So I was listening to like Neil Young and Simon and Garfunkel and Joan Baez and Buffy St. Marie and people like that. And like that was like the musical tradition that I was rooted in. But then politically, you know, bands like Against Me and Propagandhi and Os Rotten and Anti-Product. As you know, I was a fangirl before we were friends. You know, were totally inspiring to me in terms of like just how directly they spoke to the moment. That like there's no beating around the bush. They're just like, this is what's happening and this is what we have to do. And there was like an urgency to that that we really related to as like young people making music at this particular time. And so, yeah, a few of us had the idea to form a collective to kind of pool the resources from the music that we were making. We were totally at that time self-producing everything, recording everything on like cheap microphones in our basements, but then also owning the means of distribution. We spent a lot of time like in people's college, like, you know, computer labs using every CD burner on every PC in like a lab with like 20 computers to burn, you know, hundreds and even thousands of CDRs that we were selling or giving away at the time. We really rejected the idea of like corporate record labels or even copyright as kind of like a mechanism for controlling the distribution of our music. We kind of bought into that early free culture idea of like, music and creativity should be free, and we should find other ways to collectively ensure that musicians and artists are compensated for our labor. And so that was really the origins of Riot Folk, was like, there was like a group of, I guess, eight of us roughly that were kind of making similar types of music across the country. We started to find each other through protests and activism and just like online music community. And so we created this collective, and basically the way it worked is the collective would put up some amount of money to help people record or release an album or go on a tour. And then some amount of the proceeds that people made from that would go back into the collective to, you know, support future music, future releases. And really the biggest piece of it was we had a website where we put all of our music up for free download. And that was backed by archive.org because we couldn't afford the bandwidth that that required. But we were really one of the first. You know, that's like super common now, right? Like everyone has a Bandcamp or like everyone's music is on streaming services or whatever. But like back then, like that was not a thing. Like it wasn't as common that you could just like go to a website and listen to hundreds of songs by like a group of artists. And so it really did like take on a life of its own, and it went a little viral. We had like a cute little logo that was like two people in like bandanas holding hands and holding like banjos and guitars or whatever. And like, there's like maybe like 5 or 10 people on earth that have that logo tattooed on them from like that moment where Riot Folk was really big, especially spreading across Europe within like left anarchist and socialist and kind of communitarian leftist organizations and communities. And yeah, and we did a lot of touring together in like pairs or duos. Every now and then we would do like a big convergence where we'd all get together and play a big show. And I think like that's sort of like the utopian vision of it, you know. And then there was a lot of shortcomings of it too. We spent a lot of time arguing over like what to do and you know, how to structure our collective. I think for most of us, we've had a big evolution in our politics since then. I mean, just to say it, like everyone in that collective was white. And like we're bringing a certain type of kind of like white anarchist subcultural, I don't know, siloing of like what we were doing. And it wasn't until later that like I think we developed a more significant or serious anti-racist analysis. I think we also had, again, we're very into this idea of like music should be free without necessarily having a strong analysis of what does that mean for like who gets to make music or who has the privilege to tour or make an album, et cetera. Right. And so I think like, you know, we were young, we were idealistic, we had some good ideas. And over time, we also began to interrogate some of our assumptions or, you know, things that we took for granted. And, you know, I think that also led to over time, the collectives kind of starting to dissipate a bit in terms of different people going in different directions. Some folks really wanted to pursue music professionally. Other folks really, really didn't and felt like that was like immoral in some way. Right. And so, you know, I think in a lot of ways it was a really important and formative experience for me because it showed me both like the power and potential of collectivity and also the ways that lacking a strong analysis of structural power systems can lead you to fail at maybe something that you're trying to accomplish. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. That's a little bit about Riot Folk.
Well, you know, I think there's so much that we learn in this play that we do with our peers, you know, trying to experiment and figure it out. And so it sounds like there's so much that unfolded from that experience that some of that I know carries into our relationship today. But I also know that you had a different type of relationship in terms of your development with an elder, with a person who guided you, Anne Feeney. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that influence on your musical life.
Yeah, for sure. So kind of around that same time, I guess like maybe even like the year between my senior year of high school and college, I went to a gathering called the People's Music Network for Songs of Freedom and Struggle, which is sort of like exactly what it sounds like. It's like a bunch of communist grandmothers with banjos. and I, you know, it's like there's all these workshops and song swaps and things like that. And I went into a song swap. I was like 19 years old. And I busted out this song that I had written called Ya Basta, which was inspired by the Zapatistas. And this woman, like fiery red-haired woman, like made a beeline for me across the room and was like, "You got any other songs like that?" And I was like, "Yeah, kind of." And she was Anne Feeney, who I didn't know, you know, of at the time, but soon came to learn just from like how everyone else in the room was acting toward her that she was, you know, a truly legendary and renowned labor singer, feminist singer, anti-war singer, activist, hellraiser, which is what she put on her business cards. And, you know, Anne was like deeply steeped in the labor movement specifically. She took a path that very few women did at that time in becoming a labor singer and like playing in union halls for mine workers and auto workers and everyone really, and had such a way of connecting with working people. Like she believed in the power of working people in a way that moved me so much and showed me sort of a different type of organizing in politics than the kind of subcultural like anarchist scene that I was used to, but one that was really rooted in like people's lived experiences and in solidarity and in, you know, workplace action, etc. And so, you know, I met her and like we corresponded a little bit. Maybe we did a show or like one show together or something like that. And then in my sophomore year of college, I was like, you know, I liked school, but like it wasn't really what I wanted to be doing. I was starting to tour a lot more. I remember like by my second semester, I made it so all my classes were on Tuesday and Wednesday. So I would like leave school like 5 p.m. on Wednesday and like drive as far as like Cleveland, Ohio, play a show, try and make it back in time for Spanish class on Tuesday or whatever.
Right.
And so like that was kind of the mode I was in. And Anne emailed me and was like, "Hey, I just booked this like 40 show tour of the Midwest. You want to come? I'll cover all your travel. You can sell your CDs. You know, I'll pay you whatever I can as like an opening slot, you know, but like, I love what you're doing. And like, I want to get you out there." And I'd never done anything like that. And so I was like, "Yeah, absolutely." And basically dropped out of college to go on tour with Anne Feeney, she loved to always tell the story. We were like driving across Ohio and she turns to me and was like, hey, are you old enough to drive the rental car? Like thinking I was like 26 or something. And I was like, no,
oh,
I'm not even old enough to buy a beer.
Oh, God.
She called my mom to be like,
really?
Hello. Yeah, no, 100%. We're in the car. Oh, she called my mom and was like, I am currently transporting your child across state lines. Like,
good on her.
Is that okay?
Yes.
Yeah, of course my parents did know and were totally supportive, but yeah, she really taught me so much about how to make a living as a musician. You know, again, like I was really stuck in that mindset of just like music should be free and like screw capitalism, and like she was like, screw capitalism and I need to get paid because I am a worker and a working musician. And like I learned so much from her about like advocating for myself and like asking to get paid for the labor of both creating music and performing music. But I also learned so much from her about solidarity, you know, like,
right. I was just going to say that. Yeah.
Can't tell you how many times I saw Anne, you know, passing a hat for striking workers when I knew that she needed the money in that hat, you know, like we weren't having a great tour and like she was broke herself, but she was always going to show up for working people no matter what. And, you know, we played on dozens of picket lines and at protests together. We played in so many union halls together. And again, like her sense of solidarity extended in every direction. This was also when I was starting to come out as trans. And like, I vividly remember performing on stage with her at a United Auto Workers hall outside Detroit. And like, I put on a mini skirt to like go get on the stage. And she kind of like gave me a look and was like, are you sure you want to do that? And I was like, yeah, I'm going to do it. And she was like, all right, let's fucking do it. And like, we got up there and like launched into Solidarity Forever. And, you know, within 10 minutes, like all the auto workers were like, fuck yeah, like whatever, you know? And like, that was how Anne was. Like she was solid on Palestine. She was solid on sex work. She was, you know, like, for a woman of her generation, just like uncompromising on standing with oppressed people no matter what.
Right.
And I feel like I learned almost everything from her in terms of like what my current politics and the way I approach music and the labor of music is. And like, I just feel incredibly lucky. I ended up, we did, I think, 12 tours together over the next 15 years, including one after she'd been diagnosed with cancer and had been through chemo and was completely bald. You know, we played in punk rock clubs together and folk venues for, you know, and like the intergenerational aspect of it was really powerful too, where you'd have these like grandmas swinging arm in arm with like blue haired spiky punks or whatever who would come out to the shows. So I just feel like one of the luckiest people in the world to have gotten to spend so much time with her. I probably got to spend more time with her than almost anyone other than like her kids and maybe Chris Chandler, who is another of her longtime touring partners. And it was just an incredibly special relationship. I feel like a lot of people don't get to have an incredibly close friendship with someone of like a totally different generation that's not like a parent or a family member. And I just feel like so, so lucky to have had that.
Anne recently passed away, and I also feel blessed to have known you and through you gotten a chance to meet Anne. I think the first time we met was on the Rock Against the TPP tour, if I'm not mistaken, but then we went to her home in Pittsburgh. Actually, maybe even before that at Bread and Roses, I think was maybe that was the first time. But Anne really was such a fiery spirit. And I see all of these influences, her influence in you and Riot Folk and all of the things you've mentioned. But I also know that your music has evolved immensely since this time, and the way that you view the world, you know, the way that you view social justice and what that means. So I wanted to see if you could talk a little bit about how that evolution has gone and where it has landed you, both in terms of the sonic elements and also the content.
Yeah. I mean, I think the biggest shift for me has been learning to produce myself. And that was sort of a pandemic side effect in a way. Like many musicians, when the pandemic came down and all the shows got canceled and we were all just stuck in our houses. I bought this microphone actually at Gaetano's recommendation. So thanks. And I started working on some songs. And I had never recorded myself beyond just like, you know, one mic, acoustic guitar kind of vibe. But so I started learning the very basics of GarageBand, and I'd always really struggle, you know, because you produced an album for me, that I really, really struggled with recording to a click track or kind of, you know, just all of my skills were around performance, because that was what I had done. When I was in those Riot Folk days, I was playing like 250 to 300 shows a year and had zero time for like recording or like even like writing songs. Like I was just playing shows constantly. Partly because like most of those shows paid like $40 or whatever. So I had to play a lot of them to eke out a living.
Right.
So I really had never developed like the skills, the totally separate skill set of like recording music, playing in a studio, thinking through writing different parts, etc. And so just buying this cheap microphone and like getting into GarageBand and figuring out how to like layer things and play with fake drums and was just like a total revelation to me, and so empowering, because I'd always felt like, oh, I'm not good enough to do this. I have to hire like some dude to do it for me usually. Mm-hmm. And like, it was just so empowering to be like, fuck, I don't need some like cis guy to like engineer me. Like I can figure this out. I'm good at figuring things out.
Yep.
And it's just been so game changing. And I quickly learned like, oh, actually I'm like a pretty good guitarist. And like, I do have a good sense of how to like layer different instruments. I can kind of figure out how to plunk out a bass line if I really have to. And that's just been totally game changing for me. And it's allowed me to create the music I kind of always wanted to create. Like I sort of defaulted to folk basically because like that was what I felt like I had the skills to make, was just sort of like simple songs, acoustic guitar. But I'd always heard kind of like broader instrumentation or, you know, wanted it to have some distortion or harmony or whatever. And so just having the freedom to do that on my own time, you know, not paying someone else $50 an hour and just sit in my bedroom playing around and getting a sense of like, what are the sounds that I want to create, was just so enormously empowering. And that was how I put together and recorded my album Spotify Surveillance, which did like really well. Like I've spent thousands and thousands of dollars in the studio previously, and like this little dinky album that I recorded in my bedroom was like the one that finally got like Rolling Stone and Pitchfork and made it to the very bottom of the Billboard charts. And that felt just like awesome. And so I was like, okay, this is my path forward. And it's really allowed me to lean much more into how much I love punk and just other types of rock and indie rock music. I really enjoy playing with guitar layers and things like that. And so the sound is wildly different from what I used to produce. And I'd say along with that, it's like a big thing has also been giving myself the space to like write different types of songs and not feeling like every single song has to be like a raging protest anthem, but like that it's also important to like write love songs or write songs about being sad that my mom died or write songs about just like life. And I think also for me as a trans person, like it's really helped me connect with a different type of voice, where like when you're shouting over an acoustic guitar because you need to, because otherwise people can't hear you, especially when like four punk bands opened for you, you know, that's a certain type of vocal quality and delivery. And the ability to be like alone in my bedroom and practice like singing quietly or gently has been really lovely and allowed me to tap into like a different type of emotion that I can and want to convey in my music beyond just like rah, rah, anger, protest.
Right.
Even though obviously like everything I create is because I want to tear down the systems that are killing and build up systems that bring life and care and love. But, you know, recognizing that like there are lots of types of songs that help us get there.
That's right.
Not just one, has been really powerful.
That's right. Yeah. You know, when I think about how I fell in love with you as a musician, I think about I think about our tour in Europe where I got to see these fans that you had and just the joy. I mean, for those who've never gotten a chance to see you yet, you bring such humor to your performance art. you know, and so much joy to it. And I love that piece of your work. But what I really enjoy about where you've moved into now is that in a set, I can be laughing. I can feel like that riotfulness, but I can also like get choked up and feel quiet all in one set. And you do such a beautiful job of seamlessly threading all of those together. And I love that you can play you and a guitar and your voice and fill a room so fully. And I also love that now you can also, with all the arrangement that you've done with your music, can bring in those other elements when you want to. I wanted to talk a little bit about the spaces you create, because you're also a curator of spaces. You do performances yourself, but then you also host performances. So we have the Break the Chains events that you would run, and other similar events that you run today, particularly about building inclusive spaces for queer and trans community. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your experiences with that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, in some ways, again, it was like a bit of an accident. Like, I started organizing Break the Chains basically because I missed touring and I had a kid, a young kid, and like couldn't tour quite as much as I used to. And so in some ways, it was actually the first time that I was like, oh, I have a community right here in Boston. Because when I was touring so much, I kind of didn't. Like, mm-hmm. you know, I knew I had friends here and stuff, but like I could draw more people in London than in Boston because right. like I was just never here. And so being sort of tethered here a little bit, I got more involved in my local community, but also like really coming into my queer identity. What I was finding was that like, I just wasn't super satisfied with like the queer spaces that we had. Like it felt like basically they were very divided. There was like gay men's spaces where you could like go dance with like skinny white dudes like who wanted to make out with you, which is fun. I love doing that. But, you know, or there was like kind of like dyke bars or like very explicitly lesbian spaces where like even as a trans woman, I didn't feel super welcome or like I fit in. And then also just like a lot of it was like at bars. You know, maybe there'd be live music or whatever, but like mostly it was like bars, dance clubs, and like a little bit of like a corporate vibe. And so like I was kind of missing, I was like, where is like the thing like the DIY punk shows that I used to organize, but for gays? Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't know, I don't see it. And so I kind of started trying to make it. And at the time I was working out of a co-working space that was like kind of the perfect spot for it. It held 150 people. So like small, but not tiny. And we started organizing these monthly queer dance parties there where we would book nationally touring queer and trans performers and then a bunch of local folks. So it often, you know, because your band headline it. So it'd be yeah. like Taina Seely's band headlining plus like this local DJ, like this poetry troupe, this drag performer. And so it'd be sort of like a cabaret style, like a little something for everyone, almost always with live music. But also like a dance party. And so like people would kind of come for the dance party and then be like enamored with all the performers. But it wasn't about having like a super famous headliner or something like that. It was about mm-hmm. like people came because of what the space was.
Right.
And having it not in a bar made it so that we could make it all ages. And that was also just huge. And over time, it really did start to become sort of like for young people. Break the Chains were different depending on like who was playing or whatever. But over the years, I think it did become a really important space, particularly for young queer people, and even specifically young queer people of color in Boston, where like the scene is so was so frustrating, I think, in a lot yeah. of ways. And so just like, you know, even though it was me organizing it, having like a baseline commitment to like booking artists that were rooted in struggle and rooted in solidarity and just like showcasing the amazing like it wasn't hard. And like this is what's also so frustrating is like, you know, you book a show or some or like, you know, someone invites you to come play a show and there's not a lot of diversity in the lineup, and it's like it was so like I had no trouble booking easy. 4 to 5 performers yeah. every month that were predominantly trans, queer, and people of color.
Yep.
And like there were still tons of people that I wish I could have booked and never got
yep.
a chance.
Yep.
But it was just such a delight. And it was a way that I was able to connect with so many different performers and artists in my community. We raised a lot of money for different causes. And yeah, it just sort of created like a centerpiece for my music and curation, like you said. And I came to find that I really, really enjoyed that work of just like creating a space for people to have a positive experience and just thinking
through. You're so good at it. It's so much fun. I have so much fun at your parties. Oh. They really are the best spaces.
It kind of brings out my like mom instinct where I'm just like, I just want everyone to have a good time. Like, do you have enough water? you know, there's a sign in the bathroom reminding you about consent. Like, you know, just like the little details to help make it a positive experience. Again, especially for young queer people. And it was just such a joy to like see like them showing up with like their partner, their like parents drop them off or whatever. And like imagining what that would have been like when I was their age and wishing that I had had something like that. But like feeling so psyched that I can provide that for kind of the next generation.
I mean, you have so many different facets of you, you know, so there's this piece. And then, of course, we have your work with Fight for the Future, you know, which is like a whole nother realm. I know it's a large realm and we don't have a ton of time, but what are some campaigns that are happening right now that you think this particular audience of performing artists and activists, what do you think that we need to be aware of in this work?
Yeah, for sure. And in so many ways, the work that we do at Fight for the Future around digital rights impacts musicians and artists in every way. I mean, for me, one of the reasons I got into this work is because it was so clear to me that the free and open internet as a tool is the only reason that anyone has ever heard my music outside of my like immediate circle of friends. And having access to that megaphone was essential for me as an independent artist, as a trans artist, at a time when like no one, like Rolling Stone was not writing about trans singer-songwriters when I first got started. Now they do. But like that was not a thing in like the early 2000s or whatever. But like the internet was a thing. And so defending that tool and artists' ability to use it is crucial. But the flip side of that is that we've seen how big tech companies and exploitative technologies are very much weaving their way into the music industry and affecting artists negatively in a bunch of ways too. And so I'd say there's maybe like three main things that I think artists should be paying attention to in the technology policy space. So the big one is artificial intelligence. Everyone's talking about it. People are talking about both the types of AI surveillance that raises a lot of concerns about discrimination, about authoritarianism, things like facial recognition. And Fight for the Future has been pretty prominent on this. We've helped organize a boycott of big name artists like Tom Morello and Zach De La Roca from Rage Against the Machine, many others who are boycotting venues like Madison Square Garden that use facial recognition surveillance. And that's actually gotten a bunch of venues to now sign on to commit to saying, we won't use this type of technology in our venue. We want to make sure that people feel safe coming here and know that they're not going to be discriminated against by a racist algorithm. Mm-hmm. So that's a big one. And we do have a campaign, banfacialrecognition.com/venues, where folks can sign on if they want to join the boycott. And there's ways for artists, venues, and fans to sign on. So that's been a big one. The other aspect of AI is around generative AI. So, you know, folks definitely were paying attention to the explosion of ChatGPT, but there's also now concerns about, like, you can click a button and make a song that's borrows from other people's music or artwork. And what does that mean? And I think that we need a lot more complexity in that conversation. There's been what I would argue are sort of overly simplistic narratives, like all AI is theft, for example, or equating, you know, an individual artist in their bedroom using an AI tool with a giant corporation like Disney using AI to fire a bunch of people and use the AI to take their jobs, essentially.
Right.
And I think, you know, like with anything else, we need to make the conversation about power. Who has power and who is being exploited? And what we need is a world where artists have some power over our work and over the tools that we use. But I do think it's important to just recognize that like AI is not brand new. Like if you've ever used like GarageBand drums, those are AI drums that are based on real people's drumming that is a tool that is useful, potentially complicated. You can certainly make an argument that it puts some real drummers out of work. And It's something that allows a lot of independent artists, artists that don't have access to wealth, to create music that they wouldn't otherwise be able to create, right? And so like that's complexity, where it's not simple, like this is all good or all bad, but it's about what types of technology should we build and what should the rules governing it be to ensure that artists are fairly compensated for our labor, but also that people have access to tools that they can use to express themselves and to fight for the type of world that we want to live in.
Right.
So those are a few things. And then the elephant in the room is Spotify, right?
Right.
Which is incredibly dominant. You basically can't be a musician and not care about your Spotify streams. But Spotify's like Instagram or YouTube or anything else, they run a surveillance capitalist business model that's basically about monitoring what people listen to and using that information to serve ads. And so that business model is fundamentally incompatible with basic human rights and democracy and with artistry, right? Because right. Spotify doesn't actually care if music is good or bad. They are happy for you to stream lo-fi beats all day, whether they're AI generated or some studio in Sweden that they hired made right. them, so they don't have to right. pay royalties. But I think like we're at a moment where we desperately need to figure out new models for ensuring that artists can be heard and can be compensated for our labor. That's and to right. ensure that music isn't getting made to please a robot rather right. than like for thousands of years, humans have created music for each other. Mm-hmm. That's the future I want. I want us to keep making music for each other, not for some algorithm.
That's right. That's right. Evan, you have had such an extensive experience in both arts and activism, and I was wondering if you could just share one piece of advice for aspiring artists and activists.
I think my single piece of advice for folks that want to do art and activism full time is don't internalize capitalist values. Mm. For me, there was a moment where it felt like my music career was going to kind of take off, right? Or where like more people were coming to the shows, I was selling more albums, and I really, really set my mind on this idea of basically like I'm going to be a rock star. And it didn't quite happen that way. And I had a kid and I maxed out a few credit cards and I decided I needed to get a quote unquote real job. And I was so profoundly depressed because I felt like I had failed at like this game of capitalism, mm-hmm, basically. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that like the fact that I couldn't make a full-time living supporting a family of three in a city like Boston on folk music meant that my music was bad or wasn't good enough. And I was very fortunate. You know, I nannied, I worked for my parents, I did all kinds of different things. And eventually I landed at Fight for the Future, which is work that I love and find deeply meaningful. And that still leaves enough flexibility and space for me to create the art that I want to create, to play shows, to engage in artistic and activist community. And there's some synergy between myself as a performer, a speaker, a writer, and the director of a nonprofit that works on issues that I care about. And so my advice for especially young folks is like, it is so hard to make a full-time living just creating art, but that doesn't mean that you can't dedicate a huge portion of your life to doing that and still find other work that's meaningful to you and or that like allows enough space for your art. Don't make your art about just being a business. That's because right. it takes the joy out of it. By the time that's I was right. done touring 300 days a year, I started like hating the people that came to my shows because mm-hmm, I was just mm-hmm. like, you know, so mm-hmm. focused on like eking out the basis of a living that it took the joy out of making music and singing for people. And now that I have other work that pays the bills, that makes sure there's a roof over my kid's head, there's so much more joy in creating music. And I do better because right. I don't have to take the crappy show that I know is going to kind of suck. I can say, you know what? No, I'm going to hold out for something that actually makes sense and that's going to advance my career and, you know, open new opportunities. And so really, yeah, I think that's my biggest piece of advice is like, don't let capitalism trick you into thinking that you have to have like a perfect business model for your artwork in order for it to matter. Make the art that matters to you and find a way to survive in capitalism that doesn't suck your soul. And that's, I think, you know, the best any of us can do really at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. So true. I just had a conversation with some artists recently about just, you know, regardless if you're working another job or if art is your main job, really working to stay centered in it not being about the job, but being about doing what we love, which is difficult in this world. But, you know, we do the best we can. I know you got to run, Evan, but I just want to say thank you so much for being on the show. I'm so grateful. There's so much more. I hope we get to do a part two, because there's so much more that I know that you have to share. And I look forward to having you back.
Thanks for having me. Always fun to chat.
Take care. As we wrap up another dynamic episode of The Rhythm of Rebellion, I want to express sincere gratitude to our incredible guest, Evan Greer, for sharing her passion, wisdom, and unwavering commitment to justice. If you'd like to connect with Evan and follow her journey, look for her at evangreer.org or on Instagram at @thatevangreer. I'm Taina Seely, your host. You can keep up with my work on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube at Taina Seely, on Facebook at Taina Seely Music, or on my website, tainaaseely.com. All of these links will be shared in the show notes. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and leave your thoughts about the podcast. Your feedback is invaluable and helps us to continue to bring you these thought-provoking conversations. Many thanks to our editor Moses Nagel and Sina Basila Hickey at Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Until next time, peace, love, and liberation.